Now, next one we'll have a look at is the Dhammacetiya Sutta. Dhammacetiya, of course, means the Chetiya is a shrine or a monument. Usually when we use the word Chetiya these days, we use it in a similar way to a stupa. I basically use it to mean the same thing as a stupa. But in the early period, the period that we're looking at, it seems that a Chetiya was just some kind of shrine, more like a shrine than a sort of a constructed stupa like we have at the back here. So they would have like the Chetiyas would be things like a little shrine to a deva or something underneath a tree in the forest or something like this. So this particular one, the Dhammacetiya Sutta, whereas the previous one only had one corresponding sutta, this one has quite a few. It's found in the Madhyama Agama 2.13. It's also found in the Ekotara Agama 38.10, as well as in the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya in Chinese, and another version of it also found in the Pali canon itself, in Anguttara Nikaya, and finally also found in the Tibetan version of the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya. Popularity of this discourse is because it has quite historically significant, as well as being some quite lovely dhamma in it, marks the end of King Pasenadi. As have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living in the Sakyan country, where there was a town of the Sakyans named Medalumpa. Now on that occasion King Pasenadi of Kosala had arrived at Nagaraka for some business or other. They addressed Digha Karayana. Digha Karayana had the state carriages prepared. Let us go to the pleasure garden to see a pleasing spot. And Bodhi's note on this name, Digha Karayana was the commander-in-chief of King Pasenadi's forces. He was the nephew of Bandhula, the chief of the Mallas and a former friend of King Pasenadi, whom the king had killed together with his 32 sons through the treacherous contrivance of his corrupt ministers. Karayana was in secret collusion with Prince Vidudava, Pasenadi's son, to help the latter usurp his father's throne. So there's all these kind of machinations going on behind the scenes. Most of these machinations are not found in the suttas as such, but there are, as we'll see, some important hints that there might be something to it. Certainly the normal kind of stuff that you expect in these. So according to the Anguttara version of this, King Pasenadi had just won a battle. Probably would have been against Jatasattu. So Digha Karayana said, okay, let's go. State carriages were prepared. He informed the king, sign the state carriages are ready, go at your own convenience. He mounted a state carriage, drove out from Nagaraka, and went to the park on foot. He wandered in the park for exercise. And he saw roots of trees that were lovely and inspiring, quiet and undisturbed by voices, with an atmosphere of seclusion, remote from people, favorable for retreat. The sight of these reminded him of the Blessed One. These roots of trees are like the places we used to pay respect to the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened. He told Digha Karayana and asked him, where is the Blessed One living now? And he was told he was living in the Sakyan town Medalumpa. So I might continue to read from Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, but the so he said, how far is that? He says, not far, three leagues. There's still daylight enough to go there. So he said, please have the carriages prepared. We will go and see the Blessed One. And he did so. So remember, it's getting towards dark now, and he had dismounted from the carriage and entered the park on foot. On that occasion, a number of bhikkhus were walking up and down in the open, so doing walking meditation. King Pasenadi went to him and asked him, "Well, sirs, where is he living now? Where's the Buddha?" So they pointed him towards the Buddha's dwelling. Okay. So the word they're using for the dwelling here is the vihara. So there's the Buddha's vihara. Word vihara in the suttas usually used in this sense. It's obviously a building or a place where someone's living. In later usage, it came to mean the monastery as such was called the vihara. Go up to quietly without hurrying. Enter the porch, clear your throat, and tap on the panel. The Blessed One will open the door for you. Slightly curious that the monks didn't go and see the Buddha himself, but you know, you would have thought they would have said, "Oh, you know, he's the king. Ask him to wait here," and then they'd go and get the Buddha. But anyway, King Pasenadi handed over his sword and turban to Digha-Karayana then and there. Then Digha-Karayana thought, "So the king is going into secret session now, and I have to wait here alone now." Without hurrying, King Pasenadi went quietly up to the dwelling with the closed door, entered the porch, cleared his throat, and tapped on the panel. The Blessed One opened the door. Okay, and Bhikkhu Bodhi's note on this, when the Digha-Karayana gets given the sword and turban, according to the commentary, he thought to himself, "Previously, after conferring in private with the recluse Gotama, the king arrested my uncle and his 32 sons. Perhaps this time he will arrest me." The royal insignia entrusted to Digha-Karayana also included the fan, parasol, and sandals. Digha-Karayana hurried back to the capital with the royal insignia and crowned Vidudaba, the king. So, King Pasenadi entered the dwelling, prostrated with his head at the Blessed One's feet. He covered the Blessed One's feet with kisses and caressed them with his hands, pronouncing his name, "I am King Pasenadi of Kosala, I am Pasenadi of Kosala." "But great king, what reason do you show me for doing such supreme honor to this body and for showing such friendship?" And I think the Pali is the only version that actually has... Pasenadi goes on to list the actual monuments to the Dhamma Chaityas, which are various reasons why he pays such respect to the Buddha. And according to Venerable Anālaya, the five versions differ considerably on the reasons given by Pasenadi in reply. While the Majjhima Nikaya, the Majjhima Agama, and the Mulasarvastivada Kshudrakavastu versions describe similar reasons, only one of these reasons recurs in the Ekhotara Agama. This, and none of them, is found in the Anguttara Nikaya discourse. Okay, so in other words, we seem to have one fairly similar list found in the two Majjhimas and in the Mulasarvastivadaka Kshudrakavastu of the Vinaya. So probably this being sort of hailing back to a specifically a version perhaps characteristic of the Majjhima reciters, and could be that the Mulasarvastivada included their version from there. In any case, the Majjhima Agama and the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya are from similar schools. And these two, Ekhotara Agama and Anguttara Nikaya, of course, being the same or parallel collections. So interesting that there's such a difference there. So the reasons listed in the Ekhotara Agama are six reasons for Pasenadi's regard for the Buddha. Five are not found in the other versions. These five are the sublime teaching of the Buddha, the accomplishment of his noble disciples in morality, wisdom, liberation, and knowledge and vision of liberation, the existence of the four assemblies of practicing disciples, the Buddha's overcoming of the 62 views described in the Brahmajala Sutta, and the potential of recalling the virtues of the Buddha at the time of passing away, by the dint of which apparently even someone of evil bodily, verbal, or mental conduct will be reborn in a heavenly realm. Interesting proto Pure Land kind of idea hearing here. According to the Anguttara Nikaya version, the reasons for Pasenadi's faith were that the Buddha benefited many people, he was virtuous, he lived in seclusion, he was content with any requisite, he was worthy of honor and offerings, he engaged in talk conducive to the path, and he attained the four jhanas together with the three higher knowledges. Okay, so these are the different virtues of the Buddha. The last one's the Anguttara Nikaya, yeah. According to the Akotra and Anguttara. So from here we'll go back to the more mainstream presentation given in the two Madhyamas, and that's part of the, you know, it's as usual is a fairly stock thing, yeah. Certainly doesn't seem so personal, you know. It's the kind of, you know, anyone could have done there, and also as usual with these things, even though it's almost completely different, actually there's hardly anything sectarian there. The only thing is possibly this last one about recalling the virtue of the Buddha at the time of passing away, being possibly a suggestive of a later development, but more or less we just have standard categories there. Okie dokie. So to move on with the Pali text. I infer, according to Dhamma, about the Blessed One. The Blessed One is fully enlightened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way. Now, here, the translation that you have in front here is I have come to the main drift of the Blessed One's teaching, whereas Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as I infer according to Dhamma. And the Pali here, I have this dhammanvayo, is the word here, and the word actually being Dhamma. The reason why are these two different translations coming, and then anvayo is anu aya. And that being from the root air to go. So that's actually the breakdown of the compound here. It's Dhamma, which of course Dhamma can mean many different things, I mean teaching or principle or whatever. And then Anvaya is Anu, Aya, and Aya is related to the root air, verbal root air, to go. So it's going along with the Dhamma, is the literal translation, or following along the Dhamma. Anu Aya, probably following along the Dhamma. And I have come to the main drift of the Blessed One's teaching, not quite capturing it, and Bhikkhu Bodhi giving more of a interpretive translation, I infer according to Dhamma. Okay, so it's talking about an inference, and that being the more correct translation in this context. Now, Venerable Sir, I see some recluses and Brahmins leading a limited holy life for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, or 40 years. Okay, so here's a Paryantakatang Brahmacharya. Okay, so a Brahma life that has, holy life that has limits or ends. Uh, And then on a later occasion, I see them well-groomed and well-anointed with trimmed hair and beards, enjoying themselves, provided and endowed with the five cords of sensual pleasure. But here I see bhikkhus leading the perfect and pure holy life as long as life and breath last. Indeed, I do not see any other holy life elsewhere as perfect and pure as this. This is why, Venerable Sir, I infer this according to Dhamma. So, of course, it's being a very interesting remark and showing very clearly that the practice of temporary ordination wasn't done at the time of the Buddha, and not only that it wasn't done, but the fact that it wasn't done was considered very praiseworthy, at least by Pasenadi. But also, this particular passage is not at all stock. This is not something that's found elsewhere in the sutta. And to me, it seems it's exactly the kind of thing which someone like Pasenadi would indeed say. It's not relating to the profound nature of the teachings or anything like that. It's relating to something as a king, as a kind of a practical man and quite a worldly man. He can see straightforwardly, having visited the Buddha many times over the years, that he just notices this thing from his own observations about the Sangha. It's not something that he's been kind of taught as a doctrinal teaching and he's just parroting. So this kind of thing strikes me as being quite. So again, Venerable Sir, kings quarrel with kings, nobles with nobles, Brahmins with Brahmins, householders with householders, mother quarrels with son, son with mother, father with son with father, brother with brother, brother with sister, sister with brother, and friend with friend. Giving a somewhat jaundiced view of family relationships. Look, it's been known to happen, yeah. But here I see bhikkhus living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. I do not see any other assembly elsewhere with such concord. This too, Venerable, is why I refer this according to Dhamma. Praise of the harmony, and especially harmony. Okay. Okay. Again, Venerable Sir, I have walked and wandered from park to park and from garden to garden. And we've just seen him coming back from walking around in the pleasure park, so it seems to have been his habit to go for a walk for exercise after he's learned his lesson about moderation and getting too fat. Here I see some recluses and Brahmins who are lean, wretched, unsightly, jaundiced, with veins standing out in their limbs, such that people would not want to look at them again. And I thought to myself, surely these venerable ones are leading the holy life in discontent, or they've done some evil deed and are concealing it, so lean and wretched are they. I went up to them and said, why are the venerable ones so lean and wretched, unsightly, jaundiced, with veins standing out on your limbs, such that people would not even want to look at you? Fairly kind of confrontational question, one would have thought. Their reply was, it is our family sickness, great king. Interesting, huh? Here, translation says we're suffering from jaundice, but the Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation says it is our family sickness. The Pali here being bandhuka rogho. Bandhuka rogho. Bandhu being the family or relatives. Bandhuka rogho. So what does that mean? The family sickness. So Analio makes the slightly it's a bit of a killjoy, really. Remark that well, actually, you know, monks did actually argue with monks. You had the quarrel in Kosambi and various other places. And also the slightly, you know, playing well, there's plenty of monks who disrobed as well. So anyway, fair enough, but it seems that Pasenadi's talking about the generalization rather than 100%. Help there. I mean, seems to me that it means something like that they're saying, well, basically this is what happens to you when you become a monk. Here I see bhikkhus smiling and cheerful, sincerely joyful, plainly delighting their faculties, fresh, living at ease, unruffled, subsisting on what others give, abiding with a mind as aloof as a wild deer's. I thought, surely these venerable ones perceive successive states of lofty distinction in the Blessed One's dispensation, since they abide thus, smiling and cheerful, with a mind as aloof as a wild deer's. This too, venerable sir, is why I infer, according to Dhamma, about the Blessed One. And again, venerable sir, being a head anointed warrior, noble king, I am able to have executed those who should be executed, to fine those who should be fined, and to exile those who should be exiled. Yet when I am sitting in council, they break in and interrupt me. Or even though I say, gentlemen, do not break in and interrupt me when I'm sitting in council, wait till the end of my speech, still they break in and interrupt me. But here I see the bhikkhus, while the Blessed One is teaching the Dhamma to an assembly of several hundred followers, and then there's not even the sound of a disciple of the Blessed One coughing or clearing his throat. Once the Blessed One was teaching the Dhamma to many hundreds of followers, and one disciple cleared his throat. Thereupon, one of his companions in the holy life nudged him with his knee to indicate, "Be quiet, venerable sir, make no noise. The Blessed One, the teacher, is teaching us the Dhamma." I thought, it is wonderful, it is marvelous, how an assembly can be so well disciplined without force or weapon. Indeed, I do not see any other assembly elsewhere so well disciplined. So another great quality of the Buddhist dispensation, and that reminds me of a quote I once saw from I think it was Gerald Ford, U.S. president. They kick Nixon out, and he said, "Here I am, I'm the most powerful man in the world, and still people won't do what I tell them." Constant reflection for those in leadership positions. Okay. Again, venerable sir, I have seen here certain learned nobles who were clever, knowledgeable about the doctrines of others, sharp as hair-splitting marksmen. And they wander about, as it were, demolishing the views of others with their sharp wits. When they hear the recluse Gotama will visit us in such and such a town, they are formulated question thus: we will go to the recluse Gotama and ask him this question. If he's asked like this, we'll answer him like this, and so we'll refute his doctrine this way, and if he's asked like that, we'll answer like that, and so we'll refute his doctrine in that way. They hear. The recluse Gotama has come to visit such and such a village or town. They go to the Blessed One, and the Blessed One instructs, urges, rouses, and gladdens them with a talk on the Dhamma. After they've been instructed, urged, roused, and gladdened by the Blessed One with a talk on the Dhamma, they do not so much as ask him the question. So how should they refute his doctrine? In actual fact, they become his disciples. This too, venerable sir, is why I infer according to Dhamma about the Blessed One. And this, of course, many occasions like the Buddha's encounter with Satchaka and so on, where this has happened. And the same thing with certain learned Brahmins and householders and recluses, that the same thing happens. Except with the recluses, they don't just become converted, but they ask the Blessed One to allow them to go forth from the home life into homelessness, and he gives them the going forth. And then afterwards they became arahants. And they say thus: we were very nearly lost, we very nearly perished, for formerly we claimed that we were recluses, though we were not really recluses. The word recluse here translating samana, that's better translated as ascetics. We claimed that we were Brahmins, though we were not really Brahmins. We claimed that we were arahants, though we were not really arahants. But now we are samanas, we are Brahmins, we are arahants. This too, venerable sir, is why I infer according to the Dhamma. Again, venerable sir, Isidatta and Purana, my two inspectors, eat my food and use my carriages. I provide them with a livelihood and bring them fame. Yet despite this, they do not do such honor to me as they do to the Blessed One. Once when I'd gone out leading an army and was testing, testing these inspectors, Isidatta and Purana, I happened to put up in very cramped quarters. Then these two inspectors, You see, Datta and Purana, after spending much of the night in talk on the Dhamma, lay down with their heads in the direction where they had heard that the Blessed One was staying, and with their feet towards me. Then I thought, well, it's wonderful, it's marvelous. These two inspectors, Isidatta and Purana, eat my food and use my carriages. I give them a livelihood and bring them fame. In spite of this, they're less respectful to me than they are to the Blessed One. Surely these two good people perceive successive states of lofty distinction in the Blessed One's dispensation. This too is why I infer, according to the Blessed One, that according to the Dhamma about the Blessed One is fully enlightened, the Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, the Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way. And of course, that thing, that particular phrase recurring throughout this and is an abbreviation of the Itipi So chant, which we always recite, Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Svakkhato Bhagavata Dhammo Suppatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sanghoti. Okay, then Pasenadi goes on. Again, Venerable Sir, the Blessed One is a noble, and I am a noble. The Blessed One is a Kosalan, and I am a Kosalan. The Blessed One is 80 years old, and I am 80 years old. So if that's true, it's obviously shortly before the Buddha passed away. Since that is so, I think it proper to do such supreme honor to the Blessed One and to show such friendship. And now, Venerable Sir, we depart. We are busy and have much to do. So he's still 80 years old. I mean, if he's an Indian king and he makes it to 80, he's doing pretty well, I have to say. A bit ironic that he says there's much work to be done because he's just lost his job as a king. He hasn't got anything to do. One might want to question if this really was the occasion when Digha-Karayana was off usurping the throne and so on, giving it to Vidudava, that one might imagine why the Buddha didn't make a remark to that effect. Anyway, so King Pasenadi rose from his seat and after paying homage to the Blessed One, keeping him on his right, he departed. Then as soon as he'd left, according to the just to come back to that, the two ministers I've got to mention, Isidatta and Purana, according at the time of their deaths, were declared by the Buddha to be once returners. Okay, so the Sanity was quite correct that they had indeed attained to a high attainment. So what happened after this, when Pasenadi returned to the place where he left Digha-Karayana, he found only a servant woman who reported the news to him. He then hurried on to Rajagaha to enlist the aid of his nephew, King Ajatasattu. So remember that they'd had this quite difficult relationship as kings. Even though Ajatasattu was his nephew, they had fought a war, particularly over the possession of Kasi, Benares. But we've seen in the previous sutta, the Bahitika Sutta, that Ajatasattu had given Pasenadi a very valuable cloth, so they had obviously reconciled by this stage. If that's the case, then that would suggest that the Bahitika Sutta was also very much towards the end of King Pasenadi's life. But since Pasenadi arrived late at Rajagaha, he found the city gates closed, and remembering from the beginning of this particular sutta that he was supposed to be going to Medulumpa in the Sakyan Republic, and they've been saying that there's still daylight enough to go there. One wonders how you get from Sakya down to Rajagaha in the short time there was before dark would fall. Sakya was kind of a dependency of Kosala. They were kind of an autonomous region. They ran themselves, but they owed sovereignty to Kosala. And after the results of this, this was how Vidudava got to power, and then he later then destroyed Sakyans completely, so they ceased existence as an independent state. He would have had to travel right across the Vajjian Republic and then across the Ganges and then down to Rajagaha. You certainly couldn't do that today with the state of Indian roads in a car. So So anyway, he then hurried on to Rajagaha to enlist the aid of his nephew King Ajatasattu. He arrived late. The city gates were closed. Exhausted by the journey, he lay down in a hall outside the city and died during the night. So a very sad ending for a great king. Then, soon after he'd left, the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus. Bhikkhus, before rising from his seat and departing this king vicinity, uttered monuments to the Dhamma. Learn the monuments to the Dhamma, bhikkhus. Master the monuments to the Dhamma. Remember the monuments to the Dhamma. The monuments to the Dhamma are beneficial, bhikkhus, and they belong to the fundamentals of the holy life. That's what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted. It's more, perhaps more likely to be, rather than a conscious choice as such, more likely, I would suspect that it's perhaps more likely that the story got passed down in the oral tradition, but the actual Dhammacharyas themselves got forgotten in certain times and places and were kind of replaced by stock things, not necessarily as a conscious effort, but just that they tended to drift in there. But you know, you can definitely see that from this that these are much more personal and much more likely to be authentic than the that particular one with the ministers, Siddhartha and Purana. I mean, that's it's hard to really imagine that as anything other than just a straight personal recollection. Context is very kind of. No major differences between versions here. No, the Madhyama Agama and Mulasavastivada Vinaya have the same. Yeah. It does. I mean, it strikes me as that there is a that kind of over emotional thing. Maybe he's got he's intuiting some fear about what's happening. Maybe he's got some idea that there's this kind of plot going on. Things getting a bit too much for him. So yeah, and it strikes me as kind of and just one interesting note here, the Mulasavastivada Vinaya continues the story by narrating that while Pasenadi had this conversation with the Buddha, Dikakarayana left, and taking advantage of having been given the royal insignia in custody, instigated the prince, Vidudaba, to usurp the throne. This ensuing series of events ended in King Pasenadi passing away while seeking help against this dethronement. A translation of the corresponding Tibetan Shudra Kavastu account can be found in the blah blah blah. Pali commentary records a similar series of events taking place after the delivery of the present discourse. So very interesting that the same events recorded in the Pali commentary are also recorded in the Mulasavastivada Vinaya itself, in the canonical text. And this actually being quite a common occurrence, that stories which for the Pali are preserved in the commentary in other sources, and especially in the Mulasavastivada Vinaya, are placed into the canon itself. So even though that is a commentarial story, obviously it's not peculiar to the Pali tradition, but was widespread among the Buddhist tradition, historically could well have happened, with the only reservation I'd make being the somewhat peculiar idea that he could have gone off and the Buddha hadn't said anything. Unless the Buddha, of course, didn't know. Oh, no, he could have said to Pasenadi. Knock, knock. Oh, hi, it's Pasenadi. He sort of said, well, that's great to see you, but you should be careful about what your minister's doing.